and the government help and help from the municipal government has still not arrived. They came to visit us here on the street corner, but up until now, we haven't had any help from the government of the municipality of Juchitán.
Yeah, my name is Jaya Regalado. It's the only one time that we received something for help. Not other kind of people, especially governments, municipal or the federal government, they didn't bring us anything, because we don't have water. And of course, we don't have electricity. We don't have electricity. So, for example, in this moment, when it's at night, we feel really scared because, you know, the earthquake, the movement, we feel really scared because we don't have light. So it's that kind of... And, of course, we need something that... a kind of food that we can eat for these days. So...
Voices from Juchitán, Oaxaca, which was the city hardest hit by last week's earthquake off the coast of Mexico. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Amel Ahmed, and Nat Needham. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prue, R.L. Boone, Vesta Godars, and Carl Marxer, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ealy. If you want to see our hurricane and climate change coverage, go to democracynow.org, read the transcripts, the video and audio podcasts, and pass them around. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Division Midway Alliance Festival of Nations on Sunday, September 17th, at the parking lot of Duke's Country Bar and Grill here in Portland. The Division Midway Alliance Festival of Nations is an exciting festival showcasing the best of East Portland's multicultural community and businesses together in one place. Festival activities include live entertainment, food, and specialty items only available at the festival. Again, that's the Division Midway Alliance Festival of Nations on Sunday, September 17th, 11 a.m. at the parking lot of Duke's Country Bar and Grill. The address is 14601 Southeast Division. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the UN Security Council has just passed a resolution imposing new sanctions on North Korea.
The Eagle Creek fire is about 7% contained. We have a report on it from KBOO's own Barbara Bernstein.
And seven protesters were arrested in downtown Portland yesterday during demonstrations against right-wing hate groups.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 11th, 2017. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Natalie Motti. The Portland Police Bureau arrested seven protesters in downtown Portland on Sunday. The arrests were made after the protesters clashed with police, who responded by deploying flashbang grenades and pepper spray. Two police officers suffered minor injuries during the demonstrations. KBOO reporter Kyle Carezzi was in Portland on Sunday and brings us this report.
My name is Candy Brinksplenty. I'm Oglala Lakota Sioux, and I'm representing the Two-Spirit Nation.
I really like the prayer that you closed the rally with.
Thank you. Yes, definitely. As I was saying, that's part of our protocol as warriors, and all of us are warriors, being on the front line, and that's something I didn't say today. I wish I did. But each person who's standing here is an indigenous, excuse me, not indigenous, everyone is a frontline warrior. And so being a protector of the Oyate, of the people, we start with ceremony. We start with prayer, and we end with prayer. And when we were at Standing Rock, at the Two-Spirit Nation, at my camp, we upheld all the protocols, all the traditional values and the ways and the spirituality. So we would gather together, and we would smudge, and we would pray. And at the end, we would continue to pray, and we would sing that song to send off folks on their journey so that they can continue moving forward with the medicine they felt and the carried, and to continue taking that home with them and sharing it with their families. Candy, thank you. Yes, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yes.
How do you think the rally went overall?
You know, I honestly wasn't going to be a part of it because, like I said, I was at Standing Rock for almost a year. And then I was there for 11 months, and then I came home, and I decided to take a month to just do nothing and relax and heal and decompress. And I, you know, hearing all these alarms and hearing the concussion grenades, I heard two of them go off, having the helicopters follow us, it was just kind of like a flashback. And but I knew in that moment, you know, I have to be here because I know how to hold ground. I know how to lead during the midst of chaos and bring back the prayer and hold people in a way that they feel protected spiritually and that they're guided and they're led, knowing that love is at the front line.
And you said you joined the Portland United Against Hate Committee recently?
Yes, on Wednesday. And that is why, you know, I was keeping myself in prayer and healing. And when I heard about this rally and this march, and I started to look into it and ask other local folks who have been a part of the rallies, they had told me that they didn't feel that there was space and that it was dominantly led by white cis folks. And so when I heard that, I knew it wasn't about the healing that I needed. I know that being a leader, you step up and you make space and you endure what is at the front line for the people behind you so that they can continue doing the work. So when I heard that, I decided to go to the meeting and I decided to use my voice and say that I have the experience to lead in a prayerful, unarmed spiritual way. And I'm going to take leadership of the march and of this initiative because I'm going to open the door to allow people of color, QDPOC, LGBTQ, trans folks, for all of those who have been harmed by number 45's white supremacist decisions and actions. I want to make sure that there are people who are being heard and seen who have been silenced and who have been unseen in the community of Portland. So I decided to sit down and let my voice be heard. And with that, I was able to share and show the folks that we are going to continue gathering, we're going to continue organizing, we're going to continue developing our muscles so that we can be strong and stand in the face of the oppression.
Do you have any advice for anyone following Patriot Prayer to Vancouver to stand their ground, or anyone who's protesting against the alt-right in the future?
You know, I know that to always, always keep in mind their intention is for chaos. That's why they scream and they yell hateful words, because they want chaos. And I stood in the face of chaos at Standing Rock, and I did it again today. I walked up to those police officers, and those police officers were the ones who were the only people today who had aggressive words towards me. And they were trying to tell me to step back and to not pray for them. And I had told them, I'm going to pray for you, for the people behind me, and for your children and for your family, so that you continue doing your job in a safe way, so that you can continue protecting and serving, and that you can continue going home in a good way. You know, and I only had a few officers who I felt their energy, that they were scared of the prayer, that they didn't want to be smudged. But I know that that was my way of protecting myself, and those are my spiritual weapons, is to use prayer.
Well, thank you so much for everything you've done today. I thought today went great. It brought a lot of people together. And, yeah, so thank you.
Yes, thank you, too. Have a good day.
It was very heartwarming.
Yeah.
Take care.
That was an interview with Candy Brings Plenty from the Portland Two-Spirit Society by KBOO reporter Kyle Carezzi. The protests Sunday were part of a shut-down white supremacy rally in downtown Portland that had been set to coincide with a conservative rally that had also been planned for downtown Portland. The right-wing rally was moved to Vancouver, where a wall of riot gear-clad police kept rally attendees and counter-protesters separated.
Multnomah County officials said Sunday the slightly wetter weather and restrained winds have helped those fighting the now 33,000-acre Eagle Creek fire. The blaze is now about 7% contained, but there's no set time and when the hundreds of residents that were evacuated can return. The Eagle Creek fire is not expected to be fully contained until around September 30th. Conditions are predicted to dry out and become more volatile through tomorrow, but officials say that winds are not expected to be as forceful as the gusts that pushed the fire down into the Columbia River Gorge last weekend. A community meeting on the fire takes place tonight at 6 o'clock at the McMenamins Edgefield Amphitheater in Troutdale.
Last Friday, reporter and KBOO host Barbara Bernstein toured the I-84 corridor with a representative from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office in order to survey the damage done by the Eagle Creek and Archer Forest fires. In her correspondence last week, she said, quote, "Today I had the opportunity to see some of the impact of the Eagle Creek fire firsthand out towards Multnomah Falls. It's reassuring to see how little fire damage is visible from I-84. Up on the trails, I'm sure it's a different scene since most of the fire climbed the hillsides and ridges. The fire is still blazing between Tanner Creek and Eagle Creek, where they are not allowing anyone but firefighters and ODOT crews. It's reassuring to see how resilient the gorge remains and what an incredible job the firefighters have done to hold the fire back from destroying historic structures like the lodge and people's homes." End quote. Barbara Bernstein spoke with Sergeant Brian White of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office to find out more.
So right now we're headed east on Interstate 84. We're about 2 miles east of Troutdale, headed out towards Multnomah Falls Lodge.
So right now, what are we seeing?
Right now, we're seeing an area of the gorge here that wasn't immediately affected by the fire in terms of actual fire damage. As we get further east here, not far off of the freeway up into the tree line, there were areas where spot fires had occurred. And so there is sporadic damage here and there. But for the most part, this area, 3-4 miles east of Troutdale, didn't get any actual fire down onto the freeway itself. So as we get further east here, we can start to see the different layers of smoke as we look at the ridge lines off in the distance. And we'll actually start to see some of the smaller smoke plumes from the active spot fires that are still occurring.
So there was a lot of rumors back in Portland of things like Crown Point on fire. How realistic are some of the more horrific stories that are circulating in town?
Well, I can tell you that having gone yesterday, having driven around most of the area, a lot of the well-known landmarks like the Vista House at Crown Point, Multnomah Falls Lodge, a lot of these places are still intact. Some of the areas like the Vista House, the fire didn't quite make it that far. Other areas like Multnomah Falls Lodge were saved repeatedly by the valiant efforts of the firefighters who have been protecting them for several days now. So there is definitely damage in different places, but it's not as widespread as people most likely think. There's still a lot of green out here, a lot of the beauty that all of us enjoy of the gorge. A lot of that is still around. What people are going to see that's going to be different is that there's going to be some scars here and there where the fire came down and burned some of the green, the trees and the shrubs that were there.
So we're in the evacuation area now. I noticed we just passed the Bridalveil Station.
Yes. So right now we're in the Level 2 evacuation area. When we pass Vista House up here, we'll be into our Level 3 evacuation area. And so that Level 3, again, is where we notified residents that the fire was very close. We did that overnight, Monday night into Tuesday morning as the fire moved. Monday night through Tuesday midday, the fire had moved 13 miles in 16 hours, just an incredible amount of spread. So it was a very quick situation that unfolded, getting these residents in the far east part of our county out of their homes and getting them to safety before the fire came into some of their neighborhoods. As we're going east now, you can see up on the ridge ahead of us here, there are some smoke plumes from some of these spot fires that are still burning.
So I'm seeing more on the second ridge over.
Yes. So a lot of the fire damage itself ended up staying up on top of the hill closer to a large mountain, kind of east of Large Mountain up on what's called the Benson Plateau. There were spot fires that came down onto the old highway in the Shepherd's Dell area and then east of Shepherd's Dell back towards Angel's Rest, Bridalveil area, Multnomah Falls Lodge, Ainsworth State Park. There were areas where the fire actually came down by the highway. Firefighters attacked it there to keep it from spreading further.
There's a photo that's been circulating online of a scene, well, just one shot of the Angel Rest Trail close to the top, and it looks really devastated. Now, I understand that that's not what the entire trail looks like.
You know what? I haven't been up there myself, so I couldn't tell you exactly what it looks like. But yeah, there's been a lot of photos that have been passed along from different sources, and the ones that get a lot of attention, understandably, are the more sensational photos where there is damage. But again, we want to reiterate to folks that a lot of the green gorge that we know and love and recreate in, a lot of it is still intact, thanks in large part to the efforts of the firefighters and, frankly, some help from Mother Nature in the last couple of days, stopping the west winds, stopping the east winds, excuse me, and giving us some west winds, kind of pushing the fire back on itself so that the damage and the spread slows down. It wasn't nearly as significant as it was overnight, Monday night into Tuesday. The increase in humidity has been a welcome change. That's really helped the firefighters kind of get a handle on this. It's cleared out some of the smoke. So yesterday was the first day, to my understanding, that a lot of the air assets, the helicopters, planes, were able to get up and start doing some work. Before that, the smoke was just too dense that it wasn't safe for them to fly because they couldn't see cliff faces. They couldn't see what they were dropping water on. And there were crews working below them, so it just wasn't safe for them to fly.
I also have heard that there's been no use of flame retardant. They're using just water right now to put out the fire. Is that true?
That I'm not sure. You'd have to ask the fire service folks. They definitely have been using water, but as far as retardant, I couldn't speak to them.
There's a lot of concern about the environmental hazards of retardants.
There are, and as a lot of folks who know this area know, there are fish hatcheries out here. And we do have a sensitive ecosystem out here as well. And so certainly those are some of the factors.
So I'm seeing smoke on the ridges across the river in Washington.
Yes. Yeah, so that's some of the folks, some of your listeners may have been aware of that on Tuesday night, I believe, into Wednesday, a spot fire started in the Archer Mountain area. And as we start to go east here, you'll see some damage on the shore, or excuse me, on the... over here on the side, you can see some charred rock where the fire came down. Last I heard, that fire was still being worked on. So right now, we are about 2 miles east of the Bridalveil exit off of I-84. So we're only about 2 miles west of Multnomah Falls. So a lot of the damage from the fire is more easily visible from the historic highway. However, ODOT's had the historic highway closed. You can see another smoke plume there. The historic highway has been closed for several days now because of when the fire was so intense Monday night into Tuesday and it came down to the highway, there were dozens and dozens of trees that ended up falling over. The hillside became very unstable. As a result, they had a lot of rock slides. And so they're working very hard just to keep it passable for fire crews to come back and forth to deal with some of these spot fires that we're seeing.
The next story carries a content warning for sexual violence. Around 24 anti-fascists and raging grannies gathered in outer southeast Portland Friday night. They stood in opposition to an appearance by a band calling itself, quote, Rape Rock. The misogynist band, The Mentors, is currently on a tour they're billing as the Anti-Antifa Tour. Other venues on their touring schedules have canceled or have hidden the band's name on promotional materials. But the Portland venue, called Rock Hard, continued to promote the show after numerous people notified them about the band's misogyny and other issues. The night of the show, as anti-fascists began to stand across the street to protest, several white men attending the show attempted to attack the crowd verbally and physically. Members of Antifa managed to defuse the situation by talking down the attackers, and no injuries were reported. KBOO reporter Janka Soderberg was at the protest and spoke with some of those opposed to the band's appearance.
What's happening at Rock Hard PDX?
They're hosting a band called The Mentors, who describe themselves as rape rock. They're fascists, and they're having a fascist party, and we want to let them know that they're not welcome in Portland.
And it seems like they've been like pretty unapologetic about it.
Yeah, they're doing an anti-Antifa tour, which, in case for you at home, it means pro-fascist.
What do you think that having a presence out here what will the effect be? Or what do you hope the effect will be?
That they know that we're watching them.
I am absolutely convinced that we must stand up to any form of injustice or violence against anyone, anytime, anywhere, by anyone. I have been raped many times. I have daughters. I have sons, a son. I have friends. I have people I care about. I care for little old ladies who've been raped. And I don't want anyone to ever think it's cool, it's fun, it's acceptable, it's macho to rape. It's not okay for anyone, anytime, of anyone, under any circumstances. And by being here, I was afraid I might be giving them free advertising, which I do not want to do. But to not stand up against it when I can, when so many other people cannot because people of color are violated.
And what do you think is the band's message that they're, when they are using the term rape rock?
Well, they have lyrics that are very misogynist, hateful of women and children, a very perverted sense of sexuality and gender, and a self-justification. Whenever we dehumanize anyone, that's a part of war. And I don't want to have us dehumanizing anyone. And so I'm standing up to say no. And I'm not just standing here with a sign. I am standing here in prayer. I'm standing here in courage. And I'm standing here ready to put my life on the line if anyone does anything to hurt these young folks beside me.
Those were the voices of anti-fascists at a protest Friday night opposing the self-proclaimed rape rock band, The Mentors. The full interview, along with video, can be viewed on our KBOO Radio Facebook page.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Ellie Chang about the upcoming Affect Conference, an annual conference featuring stories about the work, culture, and design of social change. At 6, it's Labor Radio, radio of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: patchy smoke before 11 p.m., clear with a low around 57, north-northwest wind 6 to 11 miles an hour. Tomorrow, sunny with a high near 79. Today in history: in 1973, right-wing Chilean military officers backed by the American CIA staged a coup in Chile, overthrowing the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. And in 2001, hijackers flew two passenger jets into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York. A third jet was flown into the Pentagon, and a fourth crashed in Pennsylvania. The quote of the day is from late folk singer, labor organizer, and Korean War veteran Bruce Duncan Utah Phillips, who said, quote, "Time is an enormous long river. My elders were the tributaries. Every struggle they went through and every poem they laid down flows down to me. If I take the time to ask, I can build that bridge between my world and theirs. I can reach down into that river and take out what I need to get me through this world."
An initial assessment conducted by the Environmental Protection Agency found that at least 16 Superfund sites in Texas have been flooded and damaged by Hurricane Harvey. EPA Chief Scott Pruitt vowed that the cleanup of the flooded Superfund sites was a top priority of the EPA. However, the administration's newly released budget proposal for the agency cuts its finances by 30%. Additionally, the agency has lost more than 400 employees since the end of August. Analysis of the flooded Superfund sites found that 9 of the 16 flooded sites were located in or directly adjacent to low-income neighborhoods. In addition to the flooded Superfund sites, more than 650 oil, gas, and chemical production facilities in Texas were flooded and damaged during Hurricane Harvey.
In spite of North Korean threats to make the U.S. pay a heavy price, the U.N. Security Council today unanimously passed a resolution imposing sanctions against North Korea. The resolution was prompted by North Korea's expansion and testing of its ballistic nuclear missile program. The resolution is a watered-down version of the original sanctions proposal from the United States. Demands to ban oil imports to North Korea and freeze international assets of its government and of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un were dropped from the resolution. The new text also dropped a U.S. proposal to allow use of, quote, all necessary measures, unquote, to intercept, board, and inspect ships which are known to have violated previous U.N. sanctions. The sanctions resolution passed today imposes a ban on North Korea's textile exports, caps crude oil exports to North Korea at current levels, and steps up restrictions over the employment of North Korean workers abroad.
Months have gone by since that fateful day the Hollywood Mack stop and Portland itself came under scrutiny for the Jeremy Christian attacks. Today, KBOO Evening News brings you the first in a series of five episodes, The Hollywood Mack's Murders, A Day in May. This is the story of the murders that took place at the Hollywood Mack station on May 26th. We take a deep dive into what happened that day and what the event means for our community. We'll be presenting one episode each day this week, and we'll be airing the full hour-long series during the KBOO Fall Membership Drive on September 21st. This first episode, Voice of the People, tells the story from the scene of the crime.
A Day in May, The Hollywood Murders, Episode 1, The People Speak. It was a nearly perfect early summer afternoon when most of Portland was just tucking into a three-day holiday weekend, one of those hot, dry days that makes you want to jump into the river, the opening day of an overdue summer. Yet suddenly, at around 3:45 that Friday afternoon, when the first reports started to come in, it was as if the whole world stopped in its orbit and the planet quit spinning for a moment and the news began to sink in. On Friday, the eve of Ramadan, two men were murdered and another severely injured following an altercation with a white supremacist in Portland, Oregon. North Portland resident Jeremy Joseph Christian, 35, allegedly screamed Islamophobic and racist slurs at two teenage girls, one of whom was wearing a hijab while riding a commuter train. When Taliesin Namkai Meche, 23, Ricky John Best, 53, and Micah David Cole Fletcher, 21, intervened, Christian attacked them with a knife, killing Best and Namkai Meche in the process. It's August now, just 3 months after the event, and KBOO News is back at the Hollywood station. The story of what happened on May 26, 2017, and how it happened are still unfolding, and we're trying to see how that day will fit in the history of Portland. In this and the next four episodes of this brief serial report, we'll try to put the events of the day into a context. What do those events mean, and what significance do they have for our city? As we were interviewing and writing this story, the national media spotlight focused on confrontation in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which a white racist plowed into a group of demonstrators, killing one person. Some of the interviews you'll hear took place before the Charlottesville killing and some afterward. In our view, the Charlottesville situation only intensified the relevance of the discussion underway here in Portland. First, we're reporting from the scene, the Hollywood TriMet station. What's there now? What are the thoughts of station users as they pass through the station today? Let's hear the voice of the people. Well, I tried to find a mix of people by age, race, and apparent gender. Those I recorded were just the random folks passing through the station that day who were willing to speak with me. You'll hear these voices, not in any order, and all mixed together and coming from a range of perspectives. Ashley, Dan, Dakota, Dolly Mae Slider, Enrique de la Cruz, Isaac Des Holmes, Marette Whitney, Molly Libby, Nick Quinn, Richard Dobson, and a homeless couple that included a young man named Avery. I first asked, what did you see here that day?
And I didn't see the attack, but I was on the platform when it happened. And that was really hard to watch. I saw the people coming out of the train. It was really interesting to see the different reactions, because some people obviously were really traumatized and shocked, and others seemed kind of excited, and it really bothered me. It didn't really sink in for me for a bit, because I saw people leaving and I was a bit frightened, because, you know, you're on that platform, it's happening between me and the stairs, and I didn't, and there's, and yeah, and it's it just felt a little frightening.
The person who had, the man who was mentally ill, who did the stabbings, I've been on the same train as him over 24 times. So I've seen him before. I've seen his rants before. I've seen other things that happened. So since I wasn't there, I didn't know all the things, but I know he's a person who hates everybody, hates the world, and he feels that the world hates him. And it's kind of hard because it's at our stop. This is the stop I've been taking the train with every day for 16 years to get to and from work. When I saw the wonderful memorial that we had for the victims of the two men that lost their life and the other who was in the hospital, I was really brought to tears. I had to stop. I missed my bus. I just wanted to read things. And what I wrote was, love your enemies.
I don't like to use that station after dark, because there have been a couple instances there over the years of things happening, and it makes me a little nervous.
And then I asked, even if you weren't here at the station that day, what did you feel when you heard about what happened?
Very sad. Very, very sad.
Oh, I was devastated, because this is my commute that I go through here every day. And to see stuff like that happen, it just broke my heart, because we have to, you know, not be so cruel and so rude to one another. And unfortunately, as soon as my 75 bus left from here, and I went home and I saw all these, like, I was just there 5 minutes ago.
My reaction at first was pretty shocked. I'm not shocked at the violence. It's been escalating a lot lately. What shocked me more was how people responded to it. You see all this graffiti that says Black Lives Matter. It's been covered up by angry people who don't believe in that movement. They wrote hate speech, basically. All the hate speech really concerns me. It sounds like people don't really want to improve the way they think. All this needs is a change in mentality.
I love the tributes. When the rain came and took off some of the tributes, it was quite sad, because that whole coming together as a community to say, we don't want this to happen, was glorious. That realization that could have been me. That could have been me that died instead of those two men. I mean, that was a big reality. And I know from other people who take the Hollywood Max, like I do every day, the whole reality that, oh, we've seen him before, this could have happened to us, was a big reality. It was one of those heart-wrenching things, because this is our stop.
As being a Christian, I also feel sorry for that human being that committed the act, this person, that they would take another person's life. And that's what, you know, what can we as society do to help those people that are in that frame of mind? I see a lot of people that's in that state.
Now, I mean, I like the way Portland came together as a whole.
The situation the whole world is in right now is like in a panic mode right now. But you know what? I really believe that God has everything in control. I'm a Christian, and I believe that God has everything in control.
And then, how do we process what took place here?
I don't think that you do put it behind you. I think you remember it, and hopefully that community can come together in the future and prevent these types of things from happening.
Americans have put many things behind us. We had a president that was assassinated. We put that behind us. We had there's many horrible things that happened in America, and we was able to put them up and move on. We can put this behind us, and I'm quite sure that TriMet will do something to improve, because we have, in Portland, Oregon, we have a good TriMet bus system and TriMet. And when I get on the MAX now, I'm really alert and more alert to the things that are around me. It's almost like I have to be prepared to move, to get somewhere else or do something. And that's not only on the MAX or the bus.
And lastly, what should we be doing as a community to move forward?
Well, first, you should change the way people talk, to change the way they think, because words turn into actions, and words incite other people's actions. So if you change the way you speak to other people, you can probably change the way you interact with other people, too.
We don't get to the root of the problem, because I've always felt like if you don't get to the root, the same old fruit is going to come there. So you have to get to the root of the problem. Why people have, in this state of mind, why are they so angry and bitter?
I think anger needs to move us in a direction of social change and not in violence, because violence gets violence. And if we go that route of getting more violent, we are going to not let this get past us, and we're going to have a big problem.
When they brought him into the court, he was not sorry. He was violent and speaking out and ranting. You know, there was no guilt. There was no remorse about what he did. So that's a problem. That's a problem. They got many people in the same frame of mind that are running around just like that. What are we going to do about that?
Help this happen. The first thing I think that needs to happen is I think we really need to support mental health funding. I think that we really need as a community to understand what's ways to de-escalate situations instead of aggravate it. I think we also need to be able to know how to do things in ways where we protect others but don't harm ourselves. I think we need training on that. That is not intuitive.
Just be aware when we're on public transportation and out in the community to be careful and watchful and try to honor everyone we see. You know, I don't know if the whole community can do anything specific, but, and here's my bus.
There were so many viewpoints and perspectives that these folks raised, but two things stood out. First, most people seem to feel a kind of ownership of the station. This is my station. I come here every day. I think about this whenever I come through here. I've lost my feeling that this is a safe place. How do I get it back? And second, it's about mental health. Yes, there was hate murder here, but it's really about mental health. How do we deal with crazy people, not only on trains and station platforms, but in other public places? What should we be doing? In our second episode tomorrow, we'll talk to the mayor and other community leaders about how the event fits into the city's history and what it means in terms of race relations. How do city leaders see the long-term impact? How about the religious leaders and the Muslim community? Our third episode is about the victims and their families. What's been the impact of these murders on the lives of people directly involved in the event? Were the victims heroes? In our fourth episode, we'll try to understand the national perspective. Why has Congress failed to recognize this event? What's been its effect on the national image of Portland? Boston became Boston Strong, but what has Portland become? Is white racism somehow winning in a conflict with democratic pluralism? Is racism becoming respectable, mainstream? And finally, we ask, how do we leave this? How do we write the history of what happened that day? Will May 26th be seen as a turning point in the history of this city, or will it be just another mile marker on a long trail that begins with the systematic mistreatment of Native people and a misguided Constitution and leads to a seemingly endless series of hateful racial encounters? What results, if any, should we expect? Will there be a permanent memorial? What, if anything, have we learned from what happened on May 26th, 2017?
The decision by the current administration to repeal the DACA program was criticized today by the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Zayed Ra'al Al-Hussein, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, discussed human rights concerns around the globe in his address to the first meeting of the 36th session of the Human Rights Council. Here's what he had to say about the U.S.
In the United States, I am concerned by the government's decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program in 6 months' time, despite evidence of its positive impact on the lives of almost 800,000 young immigrants and on the U.S. economy and society. I hope Congress will now act to provide former DACA beneficiaries with durable legal status. I am disturbed by the increase in detentions and deportations of well-established and law-abiding immigrants. The number of migrants detained who had no criminal convictions was 155% higher in the first 5 months of this year than in the equivalent period in 2016. Some migrants, including long-standing residents, are now so frightened of expedited deportation, they refrain from accessing police protection and courtrooms. For example, reports of rape by Latina women in Houston fell by 43% in the first 3 months of 2017. I have publicly expressed my concerns about the anti-Semitism and racism openly voiced in Virginia last month, and which is also increasingly manifested online and in public debates. Free speech is an invaluable and essential right under both international standards and U.S. law, and it should not be weaponized by calls for violence and hatred.
That again was Zayed Ra'ad Al-Hussein, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking before the Human Rights Council this morning.
A new campaign launched by the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon is attracting attention from our state's county district attorneys. The campaign, which the ACLU calls They Report to You, has the goal of increasing voter participation in Oregon, especially for the state's district attorney races, starting with the May 2018 elections, when about a third of Oregon's DAs will be running for another term. District attorneys are the most powerful elected officials in Oregon's criminal justice system across all 36 of the state's counties, and many of those DAs often run unopposed. This is certainly the case in Multnomah County, the state's most populous county, where Rod Underhill ran unopposed 2 years ago and was voted in for his second four-year term. The ACLU's campaign focuses on accountability for the Oregon DAs and on criminal justice reform. According to David Rogers, executive director of the ACLU of Oregon, quote, if we're going to take a significant step forward in modernizing and reforming our criminal justice system, making it fairer and more effective, we're going to need much higher levels of voter engagement with district attorneys. Though the campaign was launched less than 2 weeks ago, the ACLU has already found that many Oregonians do not know what a district attorney does, and many are unaware that DA is an elected position. Our friends at The Scanner recently ran an article on the ACLU's campaign and the role of DAs in the state. The article explains that DAs are the top prosecutors of criminal offense representing Oregon on a county level. The DAs decide who goes free and who is incarcerated, how severely one is charged with a crime, and the number of charges faced. The DA also decides if a youth is tried as an adult and if an individual enters a treatment program or receives jail time. The ACLU's campaign is designed to bring awareness to the role of district attorneys and the values, policies, and practices that each county's DA stands for. While you'd think such a campaign with the goal of educating voters would be welcomed by all Oregonians, several of the state's district attorneys are taking offense. The Oregon State Legislature took a big leap in criminal justice reform when it passed House Bill 2355 in July. This bill established a system to help curb police profiling, and it also switched small possession of drugs from a felony to a misdemeanor. While HB 2355 had the support of many Oregonians across party lines, including both Governor Kate Brown and State Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, many of the state's DAs voiced their opposition. And these DAs are now voicing their opposition to the ACLU's new campaign. Clatsop County DA Josh Marquis calls the ACLU campaign a misleading effort aided by out-of-state special interests in both the left and the right. In a recent press release, Clackamas County District Attorney John Foote claims that the ACLU, the state's leading advocates for civil rights, had transformed into a, quote, radical political action committee and is targeting elected DAs during the upcoming election cycle. The ACLU's Rogers says that, quote, Foote's press release really underscores exactly why we need this campaign. DAs like him are so unaccustomed to the idea that they would and should be held accountable that the very idea sends them off the rails. Guess what, adds Rogers, that's democracy. With reform candidates gaining traction in DA races across the country, including in Chicago and Philadelphia, the ACLU of Oregon is hoping our state could be the next place to see an increase in contested races and judicial reform.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News from NV1, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Albuquerque-based advocacy group The Red Nation is calling on the city of Santa Fe to drop charges against people arrested Friday during a protest of a fiesta which celebrates a Spanish conquistador. The group also wants to see the event come to an end, saying it represents the genocide of Native Americans. According to the Santa Fe Reporter, more than 100 people protested the event, which led to at least 8 arrests after protesters were blocked by police from entering the plaza. They face trespassing charges, and one of the lead organizers of the Red Nation also faces charges of assault on an officer. Tribal, federal, and other agencies are working on disaster relief efforts for some Florida tribes impacted by Hurricane Irma, which has been downgraded to a tropical storm. On Friday, President Trump declared an emergency for the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Federal agencies, including the Bureau of Indian Affairs, are asking people to monitor the storm and follow the direction of tribal, state, and local officials. The Mississauga Tribe of Indians is also dealing with impacts from the storm. A project involving 4 Arizona tribes has received an award to help research the cultural landscape of the Lower Gila River in the southwest part of the state. KAWC's Stephanie Sanchez reports.
The Lower Gila River is rich with petroglyphs, geoglyphs, and foot trails, reminders of the ancient life it sustained thousands of years ago. Aaron Wright is a preservation archaeologist with Archaeology Southwest, a nonprofit conservation organization based in Tucson. Wright will lead a 3-year study to investigate the cultural landscape of the river using the oral histories and traditions from the Fort Yumaquitsan Indian Tribe, Cocopa Indian Tribe, the Yavapai Prescott Indian Tribe, and the Salt River Pima Maricopa Indian Community.
These particular 4 tribes have been arguably underrepresented in ethnohistoric research and just collaborative work with tribes in general.
He'll do that with the help of a $175,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Cocopa Tribal Councilman Edmund Dominguez looks forward to the collaborative effort, which he says will preserve Native history for future generations.
This is very important that we get involved so we can have a say-so and say, yes, we want to preserve these.
For National Native News, I'm Stephanie Sanchez.
People in an Alaska Native community are aiming to improve their health this fall with a Native Foods Challenge. Reporter Avery Lill tells us more.
When Igeaukig's high school literature class read In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan, they were hooked. In the book, Pollan details a 7-week project. A group of Aboriginal Australians who lived in the city and ate Western food moved to the outback and ate traditional food for 7 weeks. At the end of the period, all saw health improvements.
The kids in the class thought that'd be a great idea if we were to do this. So we pitched it to the community as a community idea, and the community members here were very excited about it.
That's Tate Gooden, Igeaukig School's head teacher. For 6 weeks, starting September 17th, the adults and children in the village are challenging themselves to eat only traditional foods, foods they've grown locally, and oatmeal. For the past 8 months, the village has been putting away fish, berries, greens, and game.
It's gotten people a lot closer together and talking about food and subsistence. People have been harvesting. I think a lot of people have been harvesting things they've never harvested before. I have people putting up sour dock and different greens. We've got people boiling down caribou bones and making fat cake.
The project is a health experiment, so residents have already begun regular health screenings. Every month in 2017, they've taken their weight, blood pressure, blood sugar, and heart rate. They'll compare the results from before and after the challenge, which ends October 28th. For National Native News, I'm Avery Lill.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Isabel Cochran, Kyle Carezzi, Don Zur, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Barbara Bernstein and Tom Flynn. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Natalie Motti.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, on alternative radio, Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, looks at capitalism versus socialism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Intersections Radio, Renee Denfeld talks about her book, The Child Finder, as well as her work on behalf of sex trafficking victims and people who have been wrongly imprisoned. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan presents the second half of his special on TBA 17, featuring interviews with Aaron Boberg and Roya Amir Soleimani. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Good night, Natalie. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
EFFECT is a community conference that features stories from activists, creators, and people in the tech field. Its purpose is to pair words with action and examine the work, culture, and design of social change. The conference partners with local Portland area nonprofits and creates group volunteer projects that attendees can choose from. We have in the studio Ellie Chang, founder of the EFFECT Conf. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about the EFFECT Conf?
Yeah, for sure. It's an indie social change conference that I started last year. So it's heading into year two this Friday and Saturday downtown at the Elliott Center.
Oh, nice. And how So it is your second year. So what are some of the speakers that would be at the Effect Conf?
There are 12 speakers total, 7 on day 1, 5 on day 2. Our keynotes are Sadet Harry, noted cultural critic, who goes by Black Amazon on Twitter, and Sean Lau, who goes by No Totally on Twitter, which is a nod to his social issues and film podcast that he runs.
Okay, so... is there like a connection between all of the speakers that will be attending the event, or just gathering a bunch of like-minded individuals to kind of give? Is it almost kind of like a TED Talk, like technology
education? It is. It's similar to a TED Talk, but I like to think that it's a little more intimate and authentic than that. My idea when I started Effect was I wanted to create a place where people could have honest conversations about, you know, the things we go through when we're trying to create social change. And what a lot of these people have in common is I'm biased, but I don't think they're as well known as they should be given all the amazing work they're doing. So I think it's important to note that these are not just all my friends that I'm inviting. These are, we had an open call for speakers, and I only invited the keynotes. So it's just people who somehow stumbled upon my conference and were just doing amazing work.
So it goes without saying that the speakers are local and in the Portland area? Or
Actually, this year we don't have as many local speakers as we do last year. I feel like we may have had a lot going on in Portland and throughout the world, and just people weren't as available. So a lot of our speakers are from out of town. So it's a really good opportunity for Portlanders to come and get to see people who aren't normally in town.
Oh, Ellie, there's a focus on the tech field here, but the audience isn't limited to people who just work in the tech industry.
No, there's a lot of speakers who are in digital media, and there's speakers who are traditional activists. One of our speakers is a visiting professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology. I mean, I realize that is tech, but that speaker is also the founder of a nonprofit called Herd.
So for KBOO listeners right now, what would be the reasons they would be attending, other than folks who are already in the technical community?
Well, it would be for people who want to learn about social issues that they may not be familiar with, because we're covering things like disability justice, and we're covering things like representation and storytelling and mental health and suicide prevention, or if they just want to go behind the scenes of some really interesting social impact projects like the Trans Documentation Project, Code for America's Clear My Record Project, and so on.
So yeah, you kind of touch base on a little bit of some of the topics that are going to be discussed at the event. What are some other topics in the Effect Conf?
Topics or themes?
Themes, topics.
Yeah. I think one of the themes is that we're really challenging the narratives of how people are thinking about social change in terms of what tactics you can take and what scale of project you can take on. Because social change is such a big area, and it requires so many people to ultimately affect change. But at the same time, at the very beginning, it does start with like an individual or just a few people. And I think this year our unintended theme is like what a movement looks like at the very beginning before it takes off.
Oh. So you said it was located in the Elliott Center this year?
Yep. That is the venue of the First Unitarian Church downtown.
Downtown.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are some of your, who are some of your partners for this conference?
Our partners this year are Sima Space, who works to create inclusive art for the deaf and hard of hearing communities. Hands on Portland, who's in turn having us do a project for people served by Meals on Wheels and Lift Urban Portland, as well as Code for Good, who had an event themselves 3 months ago in order to do projects for Free Geek, Know Your City, and Sisters of the Road.
Oh, nice. So the event will be taking place over a course of 2 days, September 15th and 16th?
Yep, that's this Friday and Saturday.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ellie, for coming and talk to us about the Effect Conf.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, no problem. So we've been talking with Ellie Chang, founder of EffectConf. EffectConf takes place Friday and Saturday, September 15th and 16th at the Elliott Center at 1226 Southwest Portland, or Southwest Salmon Street, Portland. For more information, check out their website at effectconf.com.
Have you received your KBOO Silent Drive letter in the mail? Here's your chance to support your favorite community radio station and enter a chance to win some fabulous prizes. No letter? No worries. Go to KBOO.fm to find out more about what you could win when you donate to KBOO between now and September 14th. Here's a teaser. The grand prize is a three-day, two-night stay at El Dorado Resort and Casino with airfare in the biggest little city in the world. Yes, that's Reno, Nevada. The first prize is a night out on Burnside with a night at the Jupiter Hotel, with dinner at Le Pigeon, drinks at Cider Riot, and breakfast at Grendel so you can dive deep into the Burnside nightlife. And our second prize will allow you to stock up on medicinal and recreational treats at Jane PDX. Go to kboo.fm to donate. When we come together, we build our community's resilience, and there's no better time to invest in KBOO than now.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class. For the working class, the only program of its type in Oregon or Southwest Washington. I'm Stephen Siegel, and I'm here with my co-host, Chris Reiser.
Good evening.
And also on the phone